Let's unpack this, because you know there is this massive paradox in modern medicine right now that just drives me absolutely crazy.
Oh, yeah. It's incredibly frustrating.
Right. Because we are currently living through what is arguably the golden age of inflammatory bowel disease treatment. I mean, seriously, think about it for a second. We have all these biologics,
Molecules?
yeah, small
Yeah.
molecules, JAK inhibitors, all these highly targeted therapies. We have this incredible arsenal to treat IBD that just, well, it didn't even exist 20 years ago.
It really is an embarrassment of riches compared to where we were. I mean, the sheer number of options we have for outpatients today is staggering.
Exactly. So you look at that landscape and you'd think, okay, great. Hospital care for IBD patients must be a totally solved problem by now.
You would think so.
Right. If we have better drugs, surely the outcomes for the sickest patients, ones who actually end up admitted to the hospital, must be near perfect. But then you look at the data.
And it tells a completely different story.
An almost confusing story. Readmission rates are high. Complication rates vary wildly depending on literally which hospital you happen to walk into. It's messy.
It is so messy, and you've really hit on the core contradiction there. While outpatient care has become incredibly sophisticated, inpatient care, which is the management of that acute, severe flare, remains surprisingly variable. And
Yeah.
that variability is exactly what we are unpacking today for you. We're looking at the AGA clinical practice update on inpatient management of adults with inflammatory bowel
Right.
disease.
And for those listening, this isn't just a dry textbook update. The AGA, the American Gastroenterological Association, basically commissioned this document because they recognized that inpatient care is still a bit of a wild west.
It really is, because when a patient is admitted, the stakes change instantly. The margin for error shrinks to almost zero.
Yeah.
And frankly, doing things differently just because, that's how we do it at this hospital, well, that's dangerous. So this document attempts to fix that by laying out 13 specific best practice advice statements.
13 rules to live by, or rather, 13 rules to keep your patient alive by.
Exactly. These aren't just polite suggestions, they are safeguards.
So here is our mission for this deep dive. We are going to operationalize these 13 points for you. We're going to look at the golden hour of admission. We'll get into the specific high-stakes protocols for ulcerative colitis versus Crohn's.
Right.
And we'll cover the safety measures that often get missed in the chaos of a hospital ward. And I do want to warn you, some of this is pretty counterintuitive.
Especially regarding the safety protocols, there are things in this guideline that go straight against the natural instincts of many clinicians, particularly when we get to the part about blood
Oh
thinners.
man, we will definitely get to that because it completely blew my mind when I
Oh,
read it. But let's start at the front door. The patient is in the ER or the clinic. Best practice advice one deals with the actual decision to admit. Now, usually we think admission happens because a patient is in severe pain or having way too many bowel movements.
right, symptom severity.
Yeah, but the guideline is much more specific than just saying admit for pain.
It has to be, because pain is subjective, right? The guideline explicitly lists severe disease refractory to outpatient treatment, which is your classic presentation. The meds at home just aren't working anymore.
Okay, that makes sense.
But it also flags high suspicion for IBD-related complications, so things like an obstruction or an abscess. But the one I really want to highlight, because it often gets missed until it's far too late, is significant nutritional risk or failure to thrive.
No, wait, failure to thrive. That's the term we usually associate with, like geriatrics or pediatrics. Why is it highlighted here for adults with IBD?
Because active IBD is a severely catabolic state. You have to think of the body as a furnace.
A furnace, okay.
Yeah, active inflammation burns through energy reserves incredibly fast. So if you have a patient who isn't just having diarrhea, but they're losing weight rapidly, they have low albumin on their labs, they show signs of sarcopenia, which is muscle wasting.
Wow, okay.
That is a medical emergency.
Oh, so it's not just about the gut symptoms. It's about a systemic metabolic collapse.
Precisely. If the gut isn't absorbing nutrients and the body is literally consuming itself to fight the massive inflammation, you can't just turn that around with oral prednisone and send them home with a pat on the back.
Right, they need more.
They need IV support. They need electrolyte correction. Admission isn't just about stopping the diarrhea. It's about halting the metabolic crash before the patient completely runs out of reserves.
Which leads us directly into the immediate workup. So you've decided to admit them. Best practice advice two and three kick in immediately. Number two is supportive care. So fluids, electrolytes. That's the standard stabilize the ship
stuff.
Yes,
the basics.
But number three is where the real detective work happens. It says we must evaluate for IBD-related complications and concomitant infections.
Yes, and this is the trap. This is exactly where inexperienced medical teams often fail.
How so?
Well, you see a patient with known IBD, they come in with bloody diarrhea, and your brain immediately screams, flare! You just want to hit them with IV steroids instantly to put out the fire.
Because that's what you do for a flare.
Exactly. But the guideline says stop. You have to look for the concomitant infection first.
And we're talking mainly about C. diff and CMV here, right?
Primarily, yes. Clostridioides, difficile, and cytomegalovirus. And here is why this is so hypercritical. The symptoms of a severe C. diff infection and a severe ulcerative colitis flare are clinically identical.
Wow. Identical.
Bloody stool, intense urgency, abdominal pain, fever. You simply cannot distinguish them by standing at the bedside and asking the patient how they feel.
And so if you make the wrong call, if you treat a C. diff infection with high-dose steroids because you just assumed it was a flare,
you are pouring gasoline on a fire. You are suppressing the patient's immune system at the exact moment it desperately needs to fight off a bacterial invader.
Oh, man.
Doing that can precipitate toxic megacolon. You can literally kill the patient. It is that serious.
So the rule of thumb here is basically guilty until proven innocent.
Always. You must assume an infection is driving the bus until you have the negative PCR test or the biopsy results in your hand. You never, ever just guess it's a flare.
Speaking of biopsy results, let's look at best practice advice 4. This is about the tools we use to assess the actual disease activity. The guideline explicitly says we need both biomarkers and endoscopic evaluation.
Yeah, this addresses another really common pitfall, which is flying blind. You cannot rely on symptoms alone. In IBD, there is very often a massive disconnect between how a patient feels subjectively and what the tissue actually looks like objectively.
You mean they could feel terrible, but the inflammation is actually pretty mild?
Yes. Or the reverse, which is much scarier. They might be stoic, or maybe they're on pain meds masking the severity. Or they might have irritable bowel syndrome layered on top of their IBD, making them feel way worse than the actual inflammation suggests.
So you need the hard data.
We need objective data. Biomarkers like CRP, your C-reactive protein, and fecal calprotectin give us actual numbers. But often, you need to put eyes on the mucosa. You need a flexible sigmoidoscopy.
Now, why just a sigmoidoscopy and not a full colonoscopy? I feel like if you're already going in with a scope, you might as well see the whole thing, right?
It comes down to safety. In a severe, angry, inflamed colon, the tissue is extremely fragile. It's like wet tissue paper.
Oh, that's a vivid image.
It's true, though. A full colonoscopy significantly increases the risk of perforation. You do not want to poke a hole in the bowel. You don't need to navigate all the way to the cecum to know the house is on fire. You just need to assess the severity in the rectum and the sigmoid colon to guide your medical treatment.
Got it. It balances the need for clinical information with the paramount need for patient safety. Okay, so we've admitted them. We're actively ruling out infection, and we're visualizing the disease safely. Now, I really want to jump to best practice advice 5, because when I read this one, I actually had to pause and reread it. It's about venous thromboembolism, or VTE, prophylaxis.
Yes. This is likely the single most important safety intervention in the hospital setting for these patients.
But here is the major friction point for me, and I'm sure for a lot of people listening. We have a patient who is very likely bleeding from their rectum. I mean, bloody stool is the hallmark of the disease. And this guideline says we absolutely must give them pharmacological anticoagulation.
Blood vessels. I know it feels completely wrong. The core reflex of any doctor is first, do no harm. And giving a blood thinner to a patient who is actively bleeding feels like a direct harm.
Exactly.
But you have to look at the underlying physiology. Active IBD is a highly hypercoagulable state.
Meaning their blood is extremely prone to clotting.
Highly prone. The systemic inflammation activates the entire coagulation cascade. Hospitalized IBD patients have a significantly higher risk of deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism compared to almost any other patient group in the hospital.
And a pulmonary embolism is a lot more dangerous than a little extra rectal bleeding.
That's the crucial calculus. A pulmonary embolism can cause sudden cardiac death. It is catastrophic. The amount of extra bleeding caused by a prophylactic dose of heparin or enoxaparin is usually negligible, and it's clinically manageable.
Right.
The risk of dying from a blood clot is not.
So the guideline is rigid on this. There's no wiggle room where a doctor can say, well, they're bleeding a bit too much today, let's hold off.
It's very firm. Hospitalized adult patients with IBD should receive prophylactic anticoagulation, period. Unless there is massive life-threatening hemorrhage, and we're talking true hemodynamic instability, where you're transfusing units of blood rapidly just to keep blood pressure up, you give the thinner.
Wow.
You have to treat the clot risk. You cannot treat the fear of bleeding.
That is such a clear takeaway. Don't let fear override the hard data.
Exactly. You have to trust the data.
All right, let's move into the specific management protocols. The AGA update splits the clinical universe into two distinct paths here, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Let's start with UC because it seems to be where the timing is just absolutely critical.
Severe ulcerative colitis is a true medical emergency. We have a very specific protocol for it because we know exactly what failure looks like, and we know we only have a limited window to turn it around.
Right. And best practice advice 7 gets very granular about this. It says we treat with intravenous corticosteroids at a methylprednisolone 60 milligram daily dose equivalent.
Or 400 milligrams of hydrocortisone. But let's stick with the 60 milligrams of methylprednisolone for simplicity.
Yeah, let's stick with that. But why that specific number? Why 60? If they are really, really sick, why not 100 milligrams? Why not 500? In medicine, if a little is good, isn't more often better?
You would naturally think so, but no. It's entirely a question of receptor saturation. We have solid pharmacokinetic data showing that once you hit that 60 milligram threshold, you have fully saturated the glucocorticoid receptors in the body.
So the drug literally has nowhere else to bind. It's at full capacity.
Exactly. Going higher doesn't suppress the inflammation any faster or better. It just massively increases the drug toxicity. You get higher blood sugar, a much higher risk of infection, even a higher risk of steroid-induced psychosis.
That's terrible.
60 milligrams is the ceiling. If that doesn't work, more steroids isn't the answer. You need an entirely different key for the lock.
And knowing if it works is the very next step, because best practice advice 8 introduces the 72-hour window.
This is probably the most famous rule in inpatient IBD management, but shockingly, it gets ignored far too often. You have 3 days, that's it.
Explain that to me. Why is 72 hours the absolute magic number?
Because the trajectory of the flare is set by then. If a patient hasn't shown significant clinical improvement, meaning fewer stools, less visible blood, a dropping CRP level by day 3 of IV steroids, the statistical likelihood of them suddenly responding on day 5 or 6 or 7 is minuscule.
But I imagine the temptation for the medical team is huge to just say, let's just give it one more day. Maybe tomorrow is the turning point.
The temptation is always there. But that is called therapeutic drift. And it is incredibly dangerous.
Therapeutic drift.
Yes. Because while you are waiting that extra day or two, the patient's albumin is dropping, their muscles are wasting away, and their colon wall is getting thinner and more friable. You are literally letting the window for a safe surgery close while you chase a hope that simply isn't supported by the data.
So at 72 hours, you have to pivot, hard stop.
You have to call it. Which connects directly to best practice advice 9. It states that preparations should be made for initiating rescue therapy in patients who are not responsive.
Preparations should be made. I like that phrasing.
Sure.
It implies you shouldn't start thinking about plan B on day 3. You should be actively thinking about it on day 1.
Correct. You're running parallel tracks from the moment they are admitted. Track A is the IV steroids. Track B is asking, what if these steroids fail?
Right.
You need to be checking if they have insurance approval for infliximab. You need to be checking if they have prior exposure or antibodies to certain biologics. You need to formally screen them for tuberculosis. You simply can't do all that administrative and lab work at the 11th hour when the patient is actively crashing.
What are the options for rescue therapy usually if they fail the steroids?
Usually it's infliximab, which is a biologic, or cyclosporine, which is a calcineurin inhibitor. Both act very fast, but you need them physically in the pharmacy and approved, ready to go.
And then, of course, there's the ultimate rescue therapy, surgery. Best practice advice 6 says patients should be counseled on the potential need for colectomy and have a timely referral for surgical consultation.
This is a psychological intervention as much as it is a medical one.
Really? How so?
Well, imagine you walk into a patient's room on day 4, tell them the drug's completely failed, and say, we're taking your colon out tonight.
That would be horrifying.
It is a profoundly traumatic event. The patient feels like they failed. They are terrified. They haven't had any time to process the massive life change that comes with a colectomy.
Versus introducing the surgeon on day 1.
Right. The surgeon stops by the room on day 1 or day 2 and says, hi, I'm Dr. Smith. We really hope the steroids work for you, but I'm just lurking in the background just in case. We're all a team here. It completely normalizes the option.
It reframes surgery.
Exactly. It reframes it not as a catastrophic failure of medical care, but as a valid, definitive cure for the disease in that specific moment.
That timely referral prevents the midnight scramble. It ensures that if surgery does happen, it happens on a semi-elective basis rather than an emergency crash basis.
And we know the outcomes for semi-elective surgeries, where the patient is prepped, nutritionally optimized, and the surgical team is fully ready, are vastly superior to emergency surgeries at 2.0 a.m.
Okay, so that's the strict UC protocol. 60 milligrams of steroids, a 72-hour hard stop, rescue meds ready to go, and the surgeon on speed dial. Now, let's pivot over to Crohn's disease. Because the guidelines shift quite a bit here, mainly because the biology of the disease is different.
Right. With ulcerative colitis, the problem is superficial mucosal inflammation. It's on the surface. But with Crohn's, the inflammation goes through the full thickness of the bowel wall.
And that leads to different structural problems.
Yes. That leads to strictures, which is narrowing of the bowel. It leads to fistulas, which are abnormal tunnels between organs. And it leads to abscesses, which are deep pockets of infection.
So let's talk about an obstruction. Best practice advice 10. A Crohn's patient comes into the ER. Their belly is extremely distended. Nothing is moving through. We just blast them with IV steroids like we do in UC.
This is where the nuance is absolutely critical. The advice says IV steroids should be considered only when there is clear evidence of active inflammation.
Wait, help me distinguish that. If the bowel is blocked, isn't it inflamed by definition?
Not necessarily. Crohn's is a vicious cycle of inflammation and repair. And biological repair leads to scar tissue or fibrosis. A fibrotic stricture is just like an old, thick scar on your skin. It's tough, it's physically fixed in place, and crucially, it is not actively inflamed.
And steroids don't dissolve old scar tissue.
Exactly. If you give high-dose systemic steroids to a patient with a purely fibrotic stricture, you are exposing them to all those severe side effects, the infection risk, the bone loss, the mood changes, with literally zero potential for medical benefit. The stricture simply won't open up.
So how do you tell the difference before you actually start treatment?
You need cross-sectional imaging, a CT enterography or an MRI. You look at the scans for contrast enhancement, wall thickening, edema. Those are the signs of angry active tissue.
Okay.
If you see that, steroids might actually reduce the swelling and open the pipe back up. But if the tissue on the scan looks quiet but physically narrow, that's fibrosis. That needs a mechanical fix, like an endoscopic balloon dilation or a cervical resection.
That's such a crucial distinction for the medical team. Don't medicate a mechanical problem.
Exactly. You can't drug away a scar.
Now let's talk about what might be the scariest complication for these patients, the intra-abdominal abscess. This is best practice advice 11.
This is where the strict order of operations literally determines life or death. An abscess is a contained pocket of severe infection inside the abdomen. If you follow your basic GI instinct to treat the underlying IBD with heavy immunosuppression while that abscess is sitting right there,
you break down the immune walls, keeping that infection safely contained.
And you cause massive sepsis. The bacteria will flood the patient's system. The guideline is incredibly rigid on this. Infection control must come first.
So that means drainage?
Yes. Usually percutaneous drainage performed by interventional radiology. They stick a needle in under imaging guidance, place a drain, and actively suck the pus out. Plus, you start broad-spectrum antibiotics. You absolutely must clear the infection, or at the very least get it fully under control, before you can safely restart any of their IBD meds.
It's almost like a bridge. You have to build the bridge over the infection before you can safely cross back over to treating the Crohn's disease itself.
That's a really great analogy. You always treat the infectious complication first, then you circle back to the underlying inflammatory disease.
The last Crohn's-specific point here is best practice advice 12, and this is regarding perianal disease, so fistulas and abscesses around the rectum.
This is an absolute quality of life disaster for patients. It's incredibly painful, it's messy, and it's socially isolating. The guideline heavily emphasizes a multidisciplinary treatment approach for this.
Why can't the gastroenterologist just handle this alone in the clinic?
Because medical therapy alone, like putting them on a biologic, is rarely enough to completely close a complex perianal fistula if there is any undrained infection hiding in there.
Yeah.
And conversely, surgery alone often fails because if the underlying rectal inflammation isn't treated medically, the tissue just won't heal. You need the colorectal surgeon to place a seton, which is a surgical drain string, to keep the tract open and draining. And simultaneously, you need the GI doctor to perfectly dose the infliximab to heal the tissue. They have to work in complete concert.
It really seems like breaking down medical silos is a recurring theme across all these guidelines.
It definitely is. Modern IBD care, especially inpatient care, is entirely a team sport. No single doctor can be an island anymore.
Which brings us to the final phase of the hospital stay, the exit. Best practice advice 13.
Stability of treatment response should be achieved before discharge.
Now that sounds totally obvious, right? Don't send sick people home. But how do the guidelines actually define stability?
In this context, it means the patient is safely tolerating oral intake, their pain is adequately controlled with just oral medications, and their bowel frequency has normalized to a safe, manageable level.
Okay.
But the real key to advice 13 is the second half of the statement. There must be a fully established, clear discharge transition plan.
And this is exactly where the ball gets dropped all the time, isn't it?
Constantly. We see those high 30-day readmission rates precisely because patients are discharged into a medical void.
What does a truly good transition plan look like then?
It's not just a piece of paper that says, follow up with Dr. Jones in 4 weeks. That's useless. It needs to be incredibly specific. It should say, you are tapering your oral prednisone by 5 milligrams every single week. You are starting adalimumab on this exact date. We have already verified that your pharmacy and your insurance cover it. And if you have a fever over 101, call this specific phone number immediately.
It's all the heavy logistics. You're building the physical bridge from the intensive IV meds in the hospital to the independent pills or home injections.
We call it the vulnerable phase. If that handoff isn't absolutely airtight, the patient will predictably bounce right back to the ER within a month. And the tragedy is that second readmission is often much harder to treat than the initial one because the patient is now physically weaker and mentally far more discouraged.
So let's zoom out for a second. We've walked through the strict admission criteria. We know not to miss the nutritional failure. We've covered the vital safety checks look for the C. diff, and do not be afraid to give the blood thinners.
Right.
We've detailed the UC protocol, 60 milligrams max, 72 hours to decide, and get the surgical consult early. We've navigated the Crohn's minefield drain, the abscess first, and definitely don't give steroids for a physical scar. And finally, the airtight transition plan.
It's a very comprehensive roadmap for survival.
It really is. And when you see it all laid out like this, it underscores exactly why the AGA felt the need to publish this. This isn't just a list of good advice. It's a literal standardization of patient safety.
It removes luck from the equation. That's the ultimate goal. A patient's outcome shouldn't depend on whether the specific hospitalist on duty that night happens to remember the methylprednisolone ceiling. It should just be baked into the hospital's systemic workflow.
Raising the floor of care everywhere so that everyone gets the absolute best possible chance at remission. Now, before we fully wrap up today, I do want to touch on something I found buried in the methods section of this document. It's a bit meta, but I think you listening will find it fascinating because it touches on how medical knowledge is actually built and codified.
Ah, you mean the disclaimer.
Yes, the disclaimer. The document explicitly states, and I quote, because systematic reviews were not performed, these best practice advice statements do not carry formal ratings of the quality of evidence.
Right. It's important to understand this is not a strict grade methodology meta-analysis where every single statement is backed by 20 double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trials.
So essentially, this is a group of the absolute smartest experts in the GI field getting in a room together and saying, look, based on what we know clinically and the data we do have right now, this is how this has to be done.
It perfectly highlights the subtle difference between evidence-based medicine in the strictest academic sense and true clinical wisdom.
Yeah.
We don't have a perfectly designed randomized trial for every single bedside scenario. We don't have a major trial comparing the outcomes of consulting a surgeon on day one versus day four specifically, but we know from decades of collective experience and massive retrospective data that it absolutely matters.
It's a really great reminder that medicine is still an art, even when we try so hard to make it a pure science. Sometimes you just can't wait for the 10-year multi-center study to finish. You have sick patients in front of you. You have to act on the best consensus we have right now.
And that's exactly what this document represents. It's the very best available consensus to bridge that gap between the rigid data we have and the real patients we need to save today.
That is a really powerful thought to end on. It puts all these strict rules into a very human perspective. Well, whether you're a healthcare provider trying to tighten up your ward protocols, or maybe you're a patient trying to understand the rapid decisions being made around your hospital bed, I truly hope this deep dive helps you navigate the complex world of inpatient IBD.
It's been a real pleasure to dive into it with you.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you all next time.